From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Jackie Lydon. Ever since I heard Governor Sarah Palin's speech this week, especially since I'm a woman who likes to apply this stuff on the hour, there's a line I just can't get out of my head.
I love those hockey moms. You know, they say the difference between a hockey mom and a pit bull? Lipstick.
Well, today I'm wearing Trish McAvoy's Sheer Hollywood, but I wanted to get outside my own head and find out what voters were thinking about lines like this. We've heard a lot about how college campuses are hotbeds of Barack Obama support, but how does Governor Sarah Palin play there? To find out, I went to George Mason University. It's part of the Virginia State University system in the red and blue checkered county of Fairfax, Virginia, and I asked some young Republicans what they thought.
Did you like her speech the other night?
I did.
What did you think of the pit bull and hockey mom's line? the only difference between a hockey mom and a pit bull is lipstick.
I thought it was hilarious, and it was a good jab because you know, you got to mix up the long, boring speeches that just go on for days.
That's Katrina Petz, and she's been with the George Mason Young Republicans for 2 years. Here's Elise Marsh, the group's new chairman.
I was already going to vote for John McCain. I'm a Republican. But the choice of Sarah Palin, I think, excites many young conservatives simply because she is very conservative and she's young. And again, she brings a brand new dynamic to the campaign.
Did you see students coming over, asking for more information, getting more energized? Did it have that effect here at this school?
So far, I haven't had as many people come up and ask me about Palin. What I have seen is going through Facebook and looking at all my different friends and everything, I saw so many people who were saying, you know, McCain just won my vote, or I'm so excited about Sarah Palin. I love Sarah Palin. I'm impressed by Sarah Palin.
So Palin's youth is appealing. She's 44, 3 years younger than Obama. But as happens in politics, look again, and things got a little more nuanced, especially when it comes to a divisive issue like abortion.
This is Pearl. I am a pro-life Republican. I hope that she will vote for overturning Roe v. Wade, although I'm not sure about the details of legalizing abortion in the cases of rape or incest or things like that, because in those specific cases, then I am pro-abortion.
She has said that she doesn't support abortion, even in those cases, rape or incest.
Okay, well, that's news to me. Well, hopefully in that case, she will have had enough advice, because I think if she does make it completely illegal, it'll cause a lot of controversy.
In fact, only one of the five young Republicans we talked to said they fully endorse Sarah Palin's position on abortion. But all of them said Palin had made them more excited about the GOP ticket. Still, a college Democrat named Chloe Brude says the campus remains Obama country.
Both the Democrats and the Republicans had convention watching parties in the student center, and the JC party for the Democrats, I was so much bigger for Obama. I had people come up to me and say that they didn't want to miss his speech because it was so historic and so exciting.
We talked to Republicans and to Democrats, but has Sarah Palin turned the heads of undecided voters? We ran into Christian Yingling, who blogs for George Mason's student newspaper, on our way out the door.
I thought that she was just really great because she has a quality that no other politician has. She's so vibrant, she's so young, she's just so sweet and kind and caring, it looks like. But I was a little concerned because her acceptance speech seemed really kind of negative, like every other politician.
So you're still undecided?
I'm still undecided.
Whichever way they're leaning, the students on this Virginia campus are fired up, whether the candidate's wearing lipstick or not.
Lips red as wine.
Tomorrow, we'll explore Sarah Palin's unusual brand of conservative feminism. At the Republican convention, one of the biggest zingers in Sarah Palin's speech came when she compared her experience as a small-town mayor in Alaska to Barack Obama's experience as a community organizer in Chicago. It was a theme that echoed an earlier speaker that night, former presidential candidate and New York mayor Rudy Giuliani, who openly mocked Obama's experience.
He worked as a community organizer. What?
Obama responded the next day.
The question I have for them is, why would that kind of work be ridiculous?
put that question to a real-life community organizer, Mike Kruglick, who 20 years ago took out an ad in a newspaper to bring a new organizer to the south side of Chicago. Who was that, Mr. Kruglick?
Barack Obama.
Were you surprised that community organizing became a punching bag at the Republican National Convention?
I was only surprised that it took that long, because what community organizing represents is ordinary people trying to defend their interests in their communities in a way that's totally authentic and raising issues like jobs, health care, public safety that dramatically affect their lives, whereas some politicians have exactly the opposite message for ordinary people, which is, we'll take care of the problem.
But I think what former Mayor Giuliani and Governor Palin were saying is that it doesn't give you executive experience. It doesn't lead you to make executive decisions.
What Barack has done in creating a campaign that is synthesizing the raising of grassroots money, the training of hundreds and thousands of people to organize in communities across this country, and to manage all that in a way that is very, very effective, very, very professional. It's a very high level of executive ability that's required to do that.
Give me a little picture of you and Barack Obama on the south side of Chicago, the kinds of people you were meeting, things you specifically did for them.
One of the first experiences that he had that he describes in his book, Dreams from My Father, was when we were working on trying to help people get jobs. We created what was called the Regional Employment Network. And so the first meeting that Barack describes in his chapter on Chicago was a meeting of a couple of thousand people. You know, his comment was, you couldn't help but be heartened by seeing so many thousands of people, different kinds of folks, black folks, white folks, brown folks, coming together for a common purpose.
The name, Gamaliel Foundation, what does that mean, Gamaliel?
It comes from the Bible, and it would be Gamaliel. But Rabbi Gamaliel, he was the teacher of St. Paul. And St. Paul turned out to be one heck of an organizer. He organized the Christian church.
Mike Kruglick is director of Metropolitan Organizing for the Gamaliel Foundation in Chicago and 20 other states. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Jackie.
On Wednesday, scientists in Geneva will switch on the Large Hadron Collider, which is the world's largest particle accelerator. Now, I'm sure you've heard of the doomsday scenario, that once the collider cranks up, it'll create a black hole, and that's it. It'll devour the entire world. Of course, that's unlikely, we hope. But these scientists at the European Organization for Nuclear Research, which is known as CERN, C-E-R-N, are probing some of the deepest mysteries of the universe, including black holes, extra dimensions, and an even more crucial question, can a scientist really be funny? That's our question this week on Science Out of the Box. Bob Stanek is a physicist at CERN in Geneva. He thought his colleagues might have an easier time explaining their work to the world if they had some training in improv comedy. So he brought in Sharna Halpern, the founder of the Improv Olympics and the creator of the Chicago I.O. Theater. And we have them both on the line with us now. Thank you for coming. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This idea that the Large Hadron Collider might actually create black holes, how does comedy help you explain that?
It remains to be seen, of course, but I'm thinking that at least it shows physicists that they need to think out of the box and that maybe training in improv will help us get rid of this negative attitude that most physicists tend to have and where we will say yes.
Well, saying yes, that's the great old rule of improv, isn't it, Sharna?
Yes, it is. Yes and. It's saying yes to each other's ideas and building on it. And what you need to know is it isn't just about comedy. Comedy is just a byproduct of improvisation. If you use our skills, you are going to be funny. But more important, you're going to be an excellent communicator.
We might need you at some NPR editorial meetings. What kinds of things did you do to loosen everyone up?
Oh, to loosen everyone up, we did some warm-ups like working together to form letters using the physical bodies just to form a B or a C or a T, where there was no chance to argue with each other. They just immediately had to start moving and make something together.
Bob, I have to ask, what letter of the alphabet did you help to form?
We did a whole bunch of letters. And the hardest part of that scene was actually figuring out what the letter looked like. For example, I mean, there was an L, so I laid on the floor, and my partner was the upright. And you had to think quickly.
Well, the idea there is that there's no time to say, no, no, you do this. It's immediate acceptance and building on each other's ideas. And then when you know your idea is going to be accepted, you're more spontaneous to give out more ideas.
Bob Stanek, I hear that you're doing monologues now, actually, at the IO Theater, the Improv Theater in Chicago. Can you tell me a good science joke?
You know, I don't know any science jokes. I went to look on the web for particle physics jokes, and there's like two. So I think that has to tell you something about what we do.
Well,
so what was the joke? Two protons walk into a black hole, and that's the end of the joke?
Well, it's been great speaking with both of you. Improv pioneer Sharna Halpern joined us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago, and physicist Bob Stanek was on the line from Geneva, Switzerland. Good luck with the Hadron Collider on September the 10th.
I think we're going to need it.
While those scientists are cranking up the Large Hadron Collider, there's another super collider in startup mode, the National Football League. The NFL season kicked off Thursday night with the Super Bowl champs, the New York Giants, pummeling the Washington Redskins 16-7. But the 300-pound electrons and protons don't really start flying around until tomorrow with a full barrage of 13 games. Jay Glazer reports on the NFL for Fox Sports, and he joins me from Los Angeles. Hello there, Jay Glazer.
How are you doing?
So there's a really interesting story you've been following in San Diego involving a linebacker named Sean Merriman. I understand he just got some bad news about ligaments in his knee. This is an unusual story, huh?
What happened was he actually got injured last year. The ligaments that were injured were a PCL, posterior cruciate ligament, which you really don't need to play in the NFL, and an LCL, your lateral collateral ligament, which can usually heal on its own. But when the two of them go together, that's when it can cause you some problems. Well, he saw four outside opinions as well as the San Diego Chargers team doctor, and nobody really gave him a definitive answer. If you do this, then this will happen. So he just said, basically, hey, I'm a football player. That's what I do.
You know, I got to tell you, I had an ACL, an anterior cruciate ligament surgery.
That's the bad one. That's the granddaddy of them all. If you rip that, you're out.
But if he gets hit again and does get an ACL injury, he's out. He's out for good. Doesn't the league have some responsibility to shut him down?
Yeah, but one has nothing to do with the other. He could have a fully healed LCL and PCL and still get an ACL tear. It's a totally separate injury.
I'm from Wisconsin, so I'd like to ask you about the Green Bay Packers and the off-season high drama surrounding Brett Favre.
Sure.
Now, as you know, he's the greatest quarterback in NFL history. And retired, then unretired, then after much commotion, traded to the New York Jets, and he makes his regular season debut tomorrow. So is he going to be able to get used to a completely different offensive system?
I talked to several of his teammates, his coaches. He spent an awful lot of time working extra, trying to get this system down. They have molded some things to help him to get used to it as well. So the big question is, if you remember 2 years ago and 3 years ago, Brett was terrible. Last year, he worked his tail off all offseason, came in, had a great year. Nobody knows which Brett Favre is going to show up.
Monday night, back home again, mother and brothers will all be watching Brett Favre's successor take over, and the new quarterback is Aaron Rodgers. I know how my family's reacting, but what's everyone else saying?
You know, the team is excited about him. I think the players are trying to be supportive of him. The town, they're going to hold their judgment to see what happens. But the thing also is, can he stay healthy? In the past, he's not been able to stay healthy.
But if he should go down, if anything happens to him, I understand the people behind him are just two rookies.
Yeah,
really
they have two rookies.
Not,
right.
Yeah.
So, you know, clearly they're putting all their eggs in Aaron Rodgers' basket, hoping that they'll be able to protect him, hoping that he doesn't get hurt. You know, so far, at least in the preseason, he's played very well. They're a very young team. They're the youngest team in the league. So everybody there is pretty much on the same page with Aaron Rodgers. I think they may even connect better with Aaron than they did with Brett inside that locker room.
Jay Glazer reports on the NFL for Fox Sports. Thanks very much, Jay, for being with us.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
And we leave you tonight with an essay sent in by Rebecca Sanderlin. Rebecca's husband, Bobby, is a soldier now serving in Afghanistan. She writes to us periodically to share her thoughts about life on the home front.
When I tell people that I am grateful that my husband is on his third combat tour, I get strange looks. They think I'm crazy or maybe hateful. The truth is, if given the choice, I would prefer to have him home with me right now. He is in danger, and that's a thought that never leaves my mind. I am not grateful for the uncertainty, fear, and loneliness that accompany these deployments. But I am grateful that his absence this year has freed me to focus on other things. In January, we learned that I was pregnant with our second child. A few days after receiving that happy news, we learned that my father had esophageal cancer and would likely die before the end of the year. Then, just days after Dad's diagnosis, my husband was told that he was going back to Afghanistan for his third tour. But if Bobby were not deployed now, I would not have packed up my life and moved my son 600 miles away to be with my dad during his last 2 months on Earth. Dad wouldn't have been able to read Curious George books to my son every night or to pore over old family photographs with me each day, helping to label the back so that the names and faces wouldn't be forgotten. I would not have seen the excitement in my father's eyes as he watched the screen during my 3D ultrasound, knowing that it would likely be his only glimpse of his granddaughter. I learned more about my father in those final 2 months of his life than I had learned in my 32 years. And if, 4 years ago, my husband had not deployed 2 weeks after the birth of our first child, I wouldn't know for certain that I am, in fact, capable of caring for this newborn on my own. So here I am in the final weeks of this pregnancy, juggling new baby fears, swollen ankles, and the demands of an energetic preschooler, more or less on my own. My husband is gone, and he will not be back in time to hold my hand through the contractions, just as he wasn't here to hold my tissues as I eulogize my father. He and I share moments like these via satellite phone. That is, when we're lucky and the sandstorms don't block the reception. But that's okay, because like everything else in life, there's a bright side. I get to bring this baby, a daughter, into the sisterhood, surrounded from the moment of her birth by strong women, friends and relatives with their own hardship scars, many who also have husbands deployed. A typical birth experience, with just a mother's and father's arms waiting to cradle her, doesn't seem good enough for my girl. I want her to be born for strength, groomed for it from the very beginning. I want it to be her birthright.
That essay from Rebecca Sanderlin. Her daughter was due September 14th, but we just learned that Rebecca gave birth this morning to a 7-pound, 15-ounce baby girl named Rudy Catherine Sanderlin. Congratulations, Rebecca and Bobby, and Rudy, too. That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leibniz.